13, a cooler day, maybe only 9 degrees here. Cold again to start the day on Wednesday, particularly so for England and Wales, but should be another lovely day with plenty of sunshine, more of a breeze in Scotland and Northern Ireland. We'll see some cloud moving in and eventually a little bit of rainfall. And that's your weather.
Thanks, Jay. And now our new book of the week. Dejan Sujic, director of the Design Museum in London, reads from his new book, B is for Bauhaus.
B is for Bauhaus is a book that began life as a dictionary 7 years ago. But 2 years in, I got a call from the publisher to say, dictionaries don't sell anymore. The first casualty, I guess, of the digitalization of the literary world. So this is a book which evolved into something slightly different. 40, I suppose, essays that look at the world of material objects and some immaterial ones too, through my personal experiences, the places I've been, the people I've known. Today, we start with A is for authenticity. I have a green fishtail parka that I bought in a shop on a back street in Milan. It was hanging on a rack alongside a couple of elderly flying suits and some second-hand cargo pants. It is the coat, sometimes called the snorkel, because it comes with a built-in fur-trimmed hood, that the American Army wore to the Korean War. I wanted it because it has a detachable, rust-coloured, quilted nylon lining, and because it has a complicated stock number with a narrative description of the garment and its function instead of a maker's brand name on the label. The fact that it had been worn by at least one previous owner, and probably several others before me, did not detract from its charm. I grew up in the West London suburb that produced The Who, but I was not a mod. I wear my parka now, not because I feel nostalgic about the mirror-decked Vespa that I never had, but because every time I pull a zip with a 6-inch-long green braided cord designed to be used in conditions that will be unendurably cold without gloves, I have a sense of the thoughtfulness that went into every detail. The parka seems like a garment beyond fashion, yet it is a category that has clearly taken a conspicuous place in the language of fashion. The parka is far removed from its Inuit origins and its subsequent military incarnation, so much so that it now carries multiple, mutually contradictory meanings. It is both authentic and self-conscious, the sign of a youthful hipster and a greying museum director. I wear it to the embarrassment of my family, who find it a little unseemly. I wear it because it seems somehow real. But for all I know, the authenticity that attracted me in the first place could have been lovingly and inventively faked. Authenticity is a word that makes no promises about performance. It might not necessarily involve beauty, but it does suggest an irresistible combination of sincerity with authority. In the world of mass-produced objects, these are highly desirable qualities. Even if they are slippery and hard to define, grasping them is essential to an understanding of the nature of design. Authenticity is a guarantee that an object really is what it purports to be. The more authentic it is, the more secure we can feel about its price, if not its value. But when factories make large numbers of identical objects over long periods of time, a gap opens up between what might be called the original and the authentic. Sometimes, authenticity is understood as the degree to which an artifact succeeds in replicating the bloom of the factory-fresh perfection that a mass-produced object has when it is new, but which it quickly loses in use. In other contexts, authenticity is measured by the degree to which the physical remains of an object have survived, no matter how decayed they have become. Authenticity can have mutually contradictory definitions. It can be found in the making of a faithful replica of what an object once was, or in the careful maintenance of what that object has become as the result of the passing of time. The outputs of the Bugatti car factory between 1909 and 1940 are highly prized as works of art. As a result, they are just as much the target of fakers and forgers. Ettore Bugatti kept careful records of exactly how many cars he built month by month. Even so, the price that the real thing now commands has ensured that it is not just Bugatti's wrecks and write-offs that are being authentically restored. Entirely new cars have come into being, many of which are now passed off as originals. Sometimes they have fragments of authentic cars incorporated into them. They look just like the cars made in Bugatti's day and have been restored using the same techniques and skills. It's not because they are essentially new that they are fakes in the eyes of the specialists. It is because they are missing that vital chassis number, or because the number has already been used on a car with better provenance. The argument about the nature of authenticity applies to buildings too. The issue here is more a reflection of cultural values than it is of price. In Japan, the Issei Grand Shrine is rebuilt plank by plank at 20-year intervals, yet is understood as retaining its original spirit, even if every piece of timber that goes into it is new. In the case of furniture designed by the pioneers of modernism, definitions of authenticity are even harder to pin down. An authentic example of the chaise longue, attributed to Le Corbusier, Charlotte Perriand and Pierre Jeanneret, for instance, might be understood to be restricted to one of the number made under their direct supervision. Alternatively, it could be one made today that is licensed by the Fondation Le Corbusier, the official guardian of the architect's archive, and the owner of some of his copyrights. But there are also unauthorized versions that are more faithful to what they once looked like than are the present-day official versions. The variations between them can be substantial. Cushions are stuffed with foam rather than feathers. The standard diameters of steel tube have changed since the 1920s. As a result, manufacturers who produce a version with new steel, foam cushions, and a foot detail that is not the same as the one that was used in the 1920s can still prosecute those who use authentic materials but do not have the legal right to the design. Authenticity in this context is a guarantee of legitimacy and of price, rather than of always following the original intentions of the designer. And what if the designers were still alive and had consented to modify a design to take account of contemporary production methods? Would it be their first or second idea that was the more authentic? It's a dilemma that faces Norman Foster and Richard Rogers, who find that their early work is now officially protected from unauthorized alterations by the listing process. They have to apply for permission from English Heritage to make changes to their own work. A carefully contrived version of authenticity is at its most pronounced in the design of the interior world. I am sitting in a relatively new restaurant in London. It looks as if it first opened its doors a century ago. With its elderly clock, its black and white patterned floor, and its felt curtains, positioned inside the entrance to protect against a howling Central European gale, it is a remarkably faithful recreation of something that never quite existed. For a moment, the illusion that we are in a Viennese coffee house is complete. It brings the nuanced pleasure of imagining that we have stepped inside from the black market cold of Harry Lime's Vienna under four-power occupation, if not to the Vienna of the brilliant cafe conversations of Adolf Loos and Robert Musil. Adolf Loos's American bar in Vienna, completed in 1908 with its sadomasochistic precision and restraint, has the quality of reality rather than this knowing authenticity. Yet Loos was dreaming of elsewhere too. What else could an American bar at the heart of the Austro-Hungarian Empire be but a mirage? It was authentic, but it wasn't necessarily real. It's authentic in its artistic sincerity. Loos designed an original vision that he believed in, rather than a paraphrase of the work of others. And that can be the only real measure of authenticity. C is for car. In a paraphrase of an idea formulated by Roland Barthes, the critic Stephen Bailey once claimed that if Michelangelo were alive today, he would not be wasting his time in Rome carving marble tomb sculptures for the Vatican. He would be in Detroit working on the modern world's true art form, the design of the motor car. Barthes had gone three centuries further back. He suggested that the anonymous masons of Chartres would by now be putting their creativity to good use on a Citroën production line. Behind Bailey's words was the idea that contemporary art had lost the power to reach an audience beyond the walls of the gallery. He was trying to suggest just how remarkable an object, a car, made in its millions, really is. Perhaps more than any other consumer object, cars have shaped the texture and shape of modern life. They are the distillation of both the blessings and the curses of mass production. A car can be beautiful. It emotionally engages us, and it demonstrates the extent of human ingenuity and resourcefulness. A car offers a sense of personal freedom. At the same time, their exhaust emissions threaten the future of life on this planet. They are a lethal threat to pedestrians, cyclists, and other road users. The ubiquity of the car has tended to inoculate us to its significance. But we do not have to consider a car as a piece of art to understand its huge impact on the world. It is, for better or worse, the peak of the industrial culture that gave birth to the practice of modern design. Yet its power is waning. The Ford Motor Company, founded by Henry Ford, who was no more comfortable a personality than Steve Jobs, used to be the model of the modern corporation, with its company towns, its orchestra and uniform. Apple and Google have supplanted Ford and IBM as the corporations that others seek to emulate. And while there are now companies who have managed to make cars more profitably and effectively than Ford, they are essentially in the business of refining a mature product that may have a limited future. Bart was dazzled by the beauty of the Citroën Deus. It was a car that looked so modern when it was launched in 1955 that he suggested that it seemed as if it had dropped from the sky as a visitation from another planet. This was a car that you could believe an artist of caliber might have produced. But cars are the product of many people, none of whom can operate effectively if they see themselves as artists. Bart suggested that the Deus was the exact equivalent of the great Gothic cathedrals, a car that seemed to possess the kind of perfection that is not easily achieved by human hands alone. The extraordinarily long drawn-out process that the Deus went through certainly suggests an enterprise on the epic scale of building a cathedral. It took 18 years from when it was initiated in 1937 by Pierre Boulanger for the completed car to drive down the Champs-Élysées in 1955. Boulanger wanted to make the world's best, most beautiful, most comfortable and advanced car, a masterpiece to show the world, and the Americans in particular, what France could do. Each element was in itself an extraordinarily creative piece of work. The look of the car was the responsibility of Flaminio Bertoni, who, although he could certainly draw and had an interest in sculpture, had begun his working life as an apprentice carpenter in a coach-building workshop. Bertoni, brilliant though he was as a car designer, was not much of a sculptor. And in that dissonance is the essence of the problem for those who see the car as the ultimate contemporary art form. Real cars are designed by people who do not look like artists, who do not sound like artists, and who are motivated by an entirely different set of aims and ambitions from the world of art. Designing a car is not the same as making a work of art. The car designer has to work with what is available. The artist works with ideas. A close study of a car says so much about the way we live, about the way we make things, and about ourselves. It is not art, but it is the highest achievement of design, an artifact that has a greater concentration of design talent per square inch than anything else.
Dejan Sujic was reading from his new book, B is for Bauhaus. The book is abridged by Polly Coles, produced by Clive Brill, and is a Pacificus production for BBC Radio 4, where on the horizon in a moment it's the shipping forecast, following in the wake of the sounds that take us sailing by. And now, with the time at 12 minutes to 1, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Tuesday the 15th of April. There are warnings of gales in South Utsira, Fisher and German Bight. The general synopsis at 1800, high Malin 1029, expected Humber 1032 by 1800 today. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours, Viking North Utsira, northerly 5 to 7, becoming variable 4, then southerly 5 to 7 later. Fair, good. South Utsira, northwesterly 5 to 7, occasionally gale 8 at first, becoming variable 4 later. Fair, good. 40s, north 5 to 7, becoming variable 4, then south 5 or 6 later. Fair, good. Cromarty, 4th, Tyne.